Welcome back, listeners, to another episode of Standing Post. This month, we conclude with the second part of our interview with the legendary agent, Mr. Clint Hill. Last month, we ended the show during the tense moments after President John F. Kennedy was assassinated in Dallas. This episode centers around the aftermath and some great memories of the president and Mrs. Kennedy, and the latter part of Mr. Hill's career. Please enjoy the conclusion of Mr. Hill's interview. Briefly about those minutes after he was sworn in. Were there new things that you had to engage in? Were there things that he was already saying, these are the things that we need to get done? In those few minutes afterwards, was it just waiting for the flight to get down, or what, can you describe some of the actions after he was sworn in?
There was a lot of confusion on the plane afterwards. People were trying to make decisions without talking to the principals who they were making decisions for. The people who were dealing with Mrs. Kennedy forgot to ask her when they make a decision, and the people that were dealing with President Johnson, who was now president, forgot to ask him when they were making decisions. So, I mean, at first it sounded like Admiral Berkeley was speaking for Mrs. Kennedy and thought that the autopsy should be done at Walter Reed Hospital. Well, that's not where she wanted it done, because President Kennedy had been a naval officer, and she wanted it done at Naval Hospital, which is in Bethesda. The Army general thought that we should go by helicopter from Andrews Air Force Base to Bethesda. Oh, he forgot the fact that we had a casket containing the president's body. They'd have to take a special type of helicopter. It wasn't the regular type of White House helicopter that has two small doors. And all these things were just being done. They just weren't thinking about it. And it added to the confusion. Finally, they got everything straightened out. By the time we landed in Washington, everybody knew pretty much what they were going to do. Mrs. Kennedy was going to go with the body to Bethesda Naval Hospital by vehicle. Kellerman Greer and myself and Landis were going to go with him. New President Johnson and Mrs. Johnson were going to go from Air Force One at Andrews to the White House by helicopter, and he wanted to meet with members of Congress as soon as possible after getting there. I knew that John and Caroline were waiting for their father and mother to come home, and they were at the White House. And I knew that if a helicopter landed on the White House South grounds, they would assume it was Mom and Dad, and it wouldn't be. It would be LBJ and Lady Bird. So I called the agents with the children from the plane, and I told them, take Caroline and John to Mrs. Kennedy's mother's house in Georgetown so that they're not there when all this activity takes place.
I didn't even think about that.
And so that's what they did. Then we went to Bethesda, went through the autopsy. 4 o'clock in the morning, the autopsy was completed. In the interim, I was requested to go from the 17th floor where I was with Mrs. Kennedy. We had put her up on the 17th floor, which was a suite, a presidential suite. And about 2 o'clock in the morning, they asked me to come down to the autopsy room because they wanted me to see exactly what the wounds were and everything else. And the doctors were still there so that if Mrs. Kennedy ever had any questions, I'd be able to answer them. And so they had me observe everything, went back to the 17th floor, and then at 4 o'clock, they finally got everything done, and we were ready to go back to the White House, and we did. By that time, they had brought the children back. They were sleeping in their own beds. President and Mrs. Johnson had gone from the White House to their home in the Elms in the suburbs of Washington, and so everything was all lined up. We didn't have any more problems in that regard. But then the next day, the 23rd, a lot of decisions had to be made. And Mrs. Kennedy decided that her brother-in-law, Sergeant Shriver, should be the official spokesman for the family and make most of the decision. And one of the things that had to be decided was where were they going to bury him. Members of the family wanted him buried back up in Massachusetts. But Mrs. Kennedy realized that he should be buried at Arlington. So after consultation with Secretary of Defense McNamara, took Mrs. Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Pat Kennedy Lawford, and Gene Kennedy Smith over to Arlington on Saturday the 23rd to pick out the burial site, which they did. And then we went back to the White House. The president's body had been placed in the East Room. Honor Guard had been positioned. And it stayed there until Sunday morning the 24th, when it was moved from the White House to the U.S. Capitol. And then it stayed in the Capitol until Monday, when the funeral was going to be held at St. Matthew's Cathedral. During this time, Mrs. Kennedy decided that at the time of the funeral, she wanted to walk behind the caisson. I told her that this was a very bad idea. I said, there are going to be all kinds of people on. We really can't screen everybody. I said, and besides, there are going to be over 100 visiting heads of state here to attend the funeral. And if you walk, more than likely every one of them is going to insist on walking also. And it's going to be a security nightmare. So she finally agreed. She would only walk from the White House to St. Matthews. She wouldn't walk the entire way. So that's what it turned out. That's the way it actually happened.
Mr. Hill, as I was reading through your story and what you had provided in your books, there was a time where after the assassination of President Kennedy, there was a time where depression set in. And I know that's a big thing with agents, with UD officers and even APTs in the service. But it also happens in a lot of other law enforcement organizations. And it's tough sometimes to say, I need that help. I need that help to get out of where I'm at. Can you speak to what has helped you and what has have been able to get you out of that depressive state?
Well, the events of November 22nd, 1963 have remained with me since that time. I have went through a very slow decline and into a depression over years. And it wasn't fast. It was very slow. Just what happened there just ate at me because I felt a responsibility that we were unable to fulfill. And I had been brought up that when you're given a job to do, you do it to the very end result, do it successfully until it's completed. And I always felt we hadn't completed the mission there in Dallas. And so I felt guilt that we were unable to protect President Kennedy. So from 1963 until 1975, I gradually deteriorated physically because I was dwelling deep down on this problem. And I wasn't doing anything about it. I wasn't talking to anybody. I never talked to my family about the events in Dallas. The agents that were there and the other agents in the service, we never discussed it because it was just too painful to talk about. The only time I ever did talk about it was to the Warren Commission, and that was somewhat briefly. It wasn't very much. And I talked about it on an interview I did for 60 Minutes with Mike Wallace. But after I retired, I was retired in 1975, because at that time my physical condition had deteriorated to the point where I couldn't even pass the physical exam that we had to take every year. So the Secret Service was forced to retire me. So I was retired, and then I went into a deeper depression because I was away from the job I loved. And I went deeper into a depressed state. And it wasn't until 1982 that I began to come out of that state. And the only reason I did then was a doctor friend of mine told me I had to change the way I was living or I would be dying very soon. And so I did. I changed everything I was doing, started to work out more, but still that things that happened in Dallas just haunted me. 1990, I went back to Dallas. I walked the area of Dealey Plaza, went up into the Texas School Book Depository to the sixth floor. I spent about 2 hours there and came away knowing that I had done everything I could that day. There wasn't anything more I could have done. But even so, I still had that guilt complex. In 2009, a former agent that I had worked with, both in Denver and on the detail, named Gerald Blaine, began to write a book. He had left the Secret Service about 6 months after the assassination, and he had become the head of security for IBM and had a very high position with a petroleum company. But when he was retired, he really wanted to write a book about his time in the Secret Service. And so he did so, and it was a real thick book, and it wasn't going anywhere. And he contacted a person that he knew. It was a family friend named Lisa McCubbin, and asked her if she'd help him with his book, see if they could make it more saleable or more interesting. And so she read the material, and she came to him and said, well, look, one thing you have to do, you have to talk to somebody, or I have to talk to somebody who was in Dallas, because Jerry Blaine wasn't in Dallas. He was on a midnight shift, and so he left Fort Worth and went straight to Austin, Texas. Okay. So he's missed the whole Dallas. And Jerry said to her, well, Lisa, he said, there's one person you probably should talk to, but he doesn't talk to anybody, and that's Clint Hill. And she said, well, please try and see if he'll talk to me. And so he called me in, asked me if I'd talk to her about the, and I told him I didn't want any part of it. And he pleaded and said, I'll let you read everything. It'll all be factual. So I finally said, okay, I'll talk to her. Just make the arrangements. So she came to Washington, D.C. in August of 2009. We made arrangements to meet her at the Hay Adams Hotel. And I told her I'd give her 2 hours. So I went into the meeting, and she started the interview, and I answered the questions the best I could. But I really didn't tell her a great deal. And I made a big mistake at the end. She said, I may have some follow-up questions. May I have your telephone number? And I made a mistake of giving it to her. And she started to call me. First it was like once a week, and then it was twice a week. Then it was every other day. Then it was every day. Then it was three times a day. And so we were talking back and forth. And I finally realized that every time I talked with her and told her more information about what happened, I felt better. And so finally I told her the whole thing about what happened in Dallas. And then they asked me if I would be willing to write a book of my own about my time with Mrs. Kennedy. And I said, I really didn't want to write a book. And they said, Lisa McCubbin said, well, you know, you could make it a tribute to Mrs. Kennedy. You don't have to put things in there. You don't want to put things in there. So I finally said, okay, I'll do that. So we did. And I found out that by writing that book, talking about what had happened with Miss McCubbin, it lifted just weight after weight from my shoulders, and I felt so much better. And so when I talk to people today, I tell people who, whether they're in the military or the Secret Service or any other organization, have gone through a very traumatic event, the one thing that they have to do, they want to get better, is talk to somebody about what happened. Find somebody you trust. Tell them the whole story. Get it out, because as soon as you do, you're going to feel so much better. It's a world of difference before you tell them and when you get it all out and how you feel. The biggest thing that they can do to help themselves.
Thank you for that, and thank you for being able to share that with everybody and coming today to speak to the listeners, to speak to everybody that listened to the podcast, and to be able to share those words. I know that you were responsible for the protection of Mrs. Kennedy, but there were often times that the family obviously would be together. Was there any special memories or any memories you'd had of President Kennedy?
Well, I had a great relationship with the president because I was responsible for his wife and his children, and I didn't realize it initially how important that was, but over time it came to finally penetrate my brain that I was doing a job that he was very concerned about. And in that capacity, there were often times when we would be on the road and Mrs. Kennedy would want to do something, and she would say, Mr. Hill, can you have to clear this with the president's office? I know at one time, for example, we were in New York, and former president, Mrs. Truman, were there in New York at a different hotel, and she wanted to go visit them, but she wanted to make sure it was okay with the president. And so I called the president's office, and I talked to the president's secretary, Evelyn Lincoln, and Evelyn said, just a minute, Clint. She said, I'll check with the president. Check with the boss, is what she said. And next thing I know, the president's on the phone with me, telling me what he wants Mrs. Kennedy to do and why. And so I would go and then tell her. And in this case, he didn't think it was appropriate for her to go visit him at this particular juncture.
Okay.
So we didn't. And oftentimes things like that would happen where she want clearance, and she'd ask me to obtain it by talking to the president's office. I don't know if she really thought that I would be talking to the president or not, probably so. But in any event, that's the way it always turned out. And he trusted me also, just like she did. He would ask me to do things that were somewhat out of the norm. One time I was requested to go on a 50-mile hike.
I was going to ask about that.
With Mrs. Kennedy's brother-in-law and a close friend of the president's, his closest friend, Chuck Spalding. Prince Radziwill was there, and then Chuck Spalding and the prince had a bet they made with the president. I didn't know that there had been a bet made until later that they wanted to go on a 50-mile hike. And so we were in Palm Beach, and we had just gotten down there on a Friday. It was February of 1963. And Mrs. Kennedy had said after we arrived that she and the president were going to go to this friend's house in the neighborhood to have dinner. That was the only thing they were going to do. So I had my associate, Paul Landis, stay with her to accompany her that dinner, and I went back to the hotel. I'm sitting on my bed with my shorts and T-shirt, and the phone rings. It's Mrs. Kennedy. She says, oh, Mr. Hill, she said, the president and I would like to have you do something for us. I said, fine, Mrs. Kennedy, what's that? She said, you know, Prince Radziwill is here, and Chuck Spalding, the president's closest friend, are here, and they're going to go on a little hike, and occasionally the president and I are going to go out and see how they're doing. And we know the Secret Service is going to have somebody there when the president or I go out there. And we think that should be you. So we'd like to have you accompany them. I said, okay, when do they want to start? And this was about 8 o'clock at night. And she said, at around midnight.
Oh, wow.
So I said, okay, I'll be right there. So I hung up and I sat back in the bed and I thought, what does this mean, this little hike? The distance of the hike was going to be 50 miles. I had done no preparation for anything like this. I didn't even have athletic shoes with me. I had my wingtip floor shimes. And so that's what I put on. And we went over to the presidential rip where they were staying, the house they were staying in. And with that, I had a driver from the White House, Army Sergeant. We had a station wagon. And we loaded up the back of the station wagon with some water and a few things and put the prince and Chuck Spalding in the back. And away we went out to the state of Florida, or the government had just finished building the Sunshine Parkway, and it ran inland from Palm Beach toward Fort Lauderdale.
Okay.
And that was roughly 50 miles. And so it wasn't being used by commercial traffic yet, and they were just going to open it up. So that's where we're going to walk on. So we'd go out there, and periodically we'd be walking along, and they would want something. Prince and Chuck, and they'd want steaks, orange juice, what different things, you know, water. So I'd have to send the car back to get some of this stuff.
And these requests were during the hike?
No, right in the middle of the hike. So, and then Mrs. Kennedy would come out, she and her sister, to see how they were doing. And they'd walk for maybe a half a mile with them. And they did get bit in the car and leave, and I'm there continuing on walking. And then the president would come out, and the state police would come out, and they'd be joking with us, and the president would be out there. I remember once both of them were lying in the ground taking oxygen, the prince and Chuck Spalding, because we had a medical guy from the medical office with us. And the president got there, and he chastised me for allowing them to rest. What I didn't know was that there'd been a bet. The president bet they couldn't do it, and he didn't want them to have the opportunity to rest. He wanted to drive them so they wouldn't be able to fulfill the mission, and he would win the bet. But 50 miles came, and we made it. I was so relieved we got back in the car, and I was going back to Palm Beach, and I thought, oh, God, with that bed and that hot shower is going to feel good.
How were the shoes afterwards?
They held up very well. I had some blisters, but it was remarkable that I had not worse condition feet than I did have. And we got back to the house, and when they got back there, the agent said, Clint, the president wants to talk to you. I thought, oh, God, no, now what's this going to be? So we went in the house, and they were having a little celebration there about the completion of this trip, and they were passing champagne around. And so they gave me a glass, and they said, we have a presentation for you. And he and Mrs. Kennedy had made out a badge out of construction paper. Said for Dazzle, and that was my code name. The Order of the Pacemaker. He whom the Secret Service will follow into the Battle of the Sunshine Highway. And it's signed John F. Kennedy. And they hung that around my neck. And I mean, it was, you know, everybody was laughing and having a great time. I was so damn tired, I just wanted to go to bed. And but I mean, that was kind of typical, kind of a relationship that we had.
Was there anything that you wanted to add specifically up to this point? Was there anything you'd like to?
Well, one thing about President Kennedy, we realized when he won the election in 1960 that life for the agents was really going to change from the way it had been with the Eisenhowers, because Ike was now 70 years old, and here we're coming with this new president. He's 43 years old. He's got a wife, 3-year-old daughter, and a new baby. And so everything was going to be completely different than what it had been in the Eisenhower administration. So we knew that as an outset. I had said that Eisenhower never called us by name. Kennedy knew every guy's name. He knew if you were married. He knew if you had kids. He would talk to you about it. When the detail first began to cover him in Palm Beach, it was rather warm, and some of the guys came in there from New York City, and this is November, December of 1960, and they showed up in flannel suits, and it's now 75 degrees, and they're sweating profusely. And he noticed that. He went in the house. He got a whole bunch of his own polo shirts, and he'd come out, and he'd pass them around. And all the agents would be, you know, what's this? This president giving us wearing apparel? And he said that, you know, I think you can do your job a lot better if you have the proper clothing to wear. And so he was very thoughtful of all agents.
Mr. Hill, how long did you spend your time protecting Mrs. Kennedy?
They had me stay with Mrs. Kennedy for one additional year after the assassination.
Okay.
So after the presidential election in 1964, a replacement was found for me, and I was transferred from that detail back to the White House detail.
Okay.
And I was assigned to President Johnson.
Okay.
As a shift agent.
So do you have anything you'd like to share with your time with President Johnson?
Well, I started out with President Johnson on the shift, and initially he was concerned about my being there because of the fact I had been with the Kennedy, Mrs. Kennedy, and the president, and he was afraid that I couldn't be loyal to him, that my loyalty belonged only back to the Kennedys, which Agent Youngblood went to him, explained that I was a professional, that I'd also been with Eisenhower, and that he should consider me just another agent. And so he originally thought I should be transferred away, and Rufus explained to him that it would be in his best interest if I stayed. And so he said, okay, we'll give that a try, and I stayed. And that was 1964. a little more than 2 years later, they made me the agent in charge of presidential protection. And I worked with him very closely. So, because we traveled the world, went to Vietnam a number of times during the situation in Vietnam. It was a very interesting experience. We spent a lot of time at the LBJ Ranch because he loved that down there, and he'd bring everybody there. Instead of bringing him to the White House, he'd meet with the Joint Chiefs of Staff down there, with members of the cabinet down there. And so we spent a lot of time at the LBJ Ranch in Texas. In 1968, when he gave up the presidency, said that he wouldn't accept a nomination by his party for another term as a president. Late in that year, he asked to see me on the second floor of the White House. And we sat there in the private residential area. And he asked me if I'd be willing to transfer to the former President Johnson detail in Johnson City, Texas, when he left office. And I sat there and didn't know quite how to word it. So I finally said, Mr. President, I said, I don't think my career path runs along the banks of the Pardinalis River, and I think I'd better stay here in Washington, D.C. And he just laughed, and he said, yeah, I understand. And when we left each other's company, we were friends, but he had no animosity to the fact that I turned that a chance down at all. So for the next year, they actually, I had been the special agent in charge of presidential protection, but when the Nixon administration took over on January 20th of 1969, they asked me to move over and take over the vice presidential detail, and they moved another man in, Bob Taylor, as the agent in charge of presidential protection, because they were concerned about the fact that I had been with both Johnson and Kennedy, and they were afraid that that would not be acceptable to President Nixon.
Okay.
And so I agreed to it. I asked them to make some changes on the vice presidential detail, because I knew how it had been when Humphrey was the vice president for Johnson, that the guys on that detail were very beat up. They were overworked completely, and I didn't want that to happen to them. It wasn't in the best interest of the Secret Service to have that happen. And so they did make some changes and gave us a full detail to be with the new vice president. And I stayed with him for 1 year until January of 1970.
And that's kind of what I want to ask you about with the changes. When you were the special agent in charge for the presidential protection detail, did you start or begin any initiatives within the detail that you felt that were necessary changes, things that you, for better quality of life, or the things that you were able to do for your agents who were working for you?
Oh, certainly we did. We did, especially with beginning in 1969 for the men who were on the vice president's detail. We increased the numbers of personnel so that the people that were on the detail would have some time off to be with family. We requested that certain things be made available to the vice president, which had not been available before, such as a dedicated aircraft for the vice president. If one were available, they might have an Air Force aircraft, but sometimes one wasn't available.
Right.
And I knew that, found that out from the guys who had been there. And so that's one of the stipulations I made, that there has to be a dedicated aircraft whose crew and plane is always available whenever the vice president needs them. And so the Air Force agreed to do that for the Secret Service. Not for me, but for the office of the vice president. And we did all kinds of things like that, try to give the guys a chance to have more time with their family, because it had been very difficult for the previous group that was there.
And oftentimes these policies would come down, and you, if you didn't have the equipment necessary, it was still that you had to fulfill the mission regardless of the equipment, the personnel. And so you pretty much, all that kind of came up later, but you still had to work the shifts. You had to travel when you needed to provide the protection.
We had to do the job with what other manpower and equipment we had, and we'd fill in the gaps as we went along. We didn't have any choice. I mean, we were given the responsibility. Now do it. Like during the Nixon administration, he required certain things to be done that we had not done previously. I believe it was 1972, at which time I was the assistant director for protective forces. President France visited the United States, and he was on a trip, multi-city trip, and when he was in Chicago, there were hecklers and demonstrators, and he was spat upon, and President Nixon got very upset about this. So he ordered the Secret Service to send a team to New York to observe how the State Department was handling the security for visiting heads of state. And so I was one of three that went to New York City to visually look and see what was going on, and it was I was then the deputy assistant director, and the assistant director for both protection and for investigations. The three of us went to New York, and we were not satisfied with the way the diplomatic service was being was handling the visiting former president or the visiting president. And so we recommended that they increase either their manpower, enabling them to do a better job. Well, Nixon decided that was not necessarily what he wanted to do. He would make the Secret Service responsible for the protection of all visiting heads of state, heads of government, and U.S. officials traveling abroad under special circumstances. And that, so they had, eventually laws were passed to make that a reality, and that's what exists today. And that all started because of an incident that happened in Chicago with the former, with the visiting president of France on a trip to the United States. It has become a very big problem for the Secret Service manpower-wise.
Okay.
And because it turns out that in September of every year, the United Nations General Assembly meets in New York, and hundreds of visiting heads of state and heads of government come there for that meeting. And the Secret Service is responsible for all of them. And so in September of every year, almost the entire Secret Service is required to be in New York City to handle this massive gathering of heads of state. And so it's a big logistical problem and security nightmare, and it goes on year after year.
And just to reiterate, you were there when that policy came down in the first United Nations General Assembly, like when you had to start doing protection for all the heads of state?
I was. It was UN 25. I can remember it like it was yesterday.
Mr. Hill, during your time within the service, you also saw the swearing in of the first female agents of the Secret Service. Can you talk a little bit about that time?
Initially, in about, I think it was 1971, the decision was made. We had been talking about this for some time, about the need for female agents to work not only in protection, but work undercover, all kinds of different situations, because it was a big need. And we had always been relying on local police departments to provide that kind of personnel to make it possible for us to do certain things. So it was decided to hire some of these females and see how it would work out. So initially, they didn't want to make them agents. So initially, they hired seven, and they were all made members of the uniform division. At that time, it was called the Executive Protective Service. And so they were sworn in, but almost all of them were at that time then began to be used in protective missions and for various different people, visiting wives of heads of state and that kind of thing. And so then by, I think, 1972 it was, the decision was made to make these, which were now uniformed officers, to swear them in as agents. Now, as I recall, there were seven, maybe it was six, but anyway, one of them was pregnant. So we had to make the decision, could we swear her in to be an agent, knowing she couldn't pass the physical requirements for an agent? And the decision was made, no, can't swear her in. And so she was really upset. I mean, she called me every name in the book, including a pig, because of the fact the decision had been made that the other eight gals would all become agents, and she could not until such time as child she was bearing was born and she was physically able to do all of the things required of an agent. But that's when the female officers became agents. And I understand now there's a considerable number of females as agents in the Secret Service, and I think it's a wonderful thing to have happened, and I think it's extremely necessary, and I'm very pleased that that happened.
Mr. Hill, I do have to ask the question, if you could do it all over again, would you go back into the Secret Service?
I love my time in the Secret Service very, very much. I have offered my services, but for some reason they don't want an 86-year-old agent working the follow-up car. So, yes, I'd do it again tomorrow if I had the opportunity.
Mr. Hill, it was amazing to have you on the show. I thank you for everything that you've done for us to be able to make it here and to speak to me and to speak to the listeners about your time in the Secret Service and what you've been able to provide us and what you've been able to do. Is there anything that you'd like to leave with the listeners, any final message?
Well, I know that Ms. McCumber and I travel across this country and internationally a great deal now because of the books that we've written and talking about them. And the one thing that I insist on doing is going and visiting the field offices of the Secret Service in almost every locality that we go to. And I talk to the agents in charge, to their staff, and to the younger agents, some who just are brand new on the job, and try to make sure they understand the importance of the job, how difficult it can be, and you must have the willingness to sacrifice a little bit. It's in your own best interest to do a job the best of your ability, and that's the only way you're ever going to get ahead. But I find that morale among the agencies that I've talked with, morale is quite high, and so I was very pleased. And I'll have to say this, that the Secret Service in 2018 has a great more challenges than we ever had back in the 1950s, 60s, or 70s. It is much more difficult a job today than it was then. There are maybe more people within the organization. They certainly have much better training than we had and much better equipment, but the challenges they face are much greater than we ever faced. So I just wish them the very best. Stay in there, do the best you can, and it'll pay off for you in the future.
Thank you very much.
Thank you again for listening to Standing Post. The staff and I would like to thank again Mr. Clint Hill and Ms. Lisa McCubbin for making this interview possible. I also want to thank you, the listener, for staying with us. If you enjoy the podcast, we ask that you tell your friends and family about us. Until next month, stay vigilant.